So last week I was at, for the last week, since from last Sunday onward then, until Friday, I was at Tassajara, and I was leading a retreat down there for about 27 people, 28 people, and the theme was the Buddha's teachings on love. And it was lovely to be at Tassajara to do this, because one of my wonderful experiences in my encounter with Buddhism, Buddhist practice, was to discover so many different intense qualities of love which can arise out of Buddhist practice, and that's talked about in the Buddhist teachings. And Tassajara was probably one of the first places where I discovered really strongly the quality of loving kindness. And I remember going back to Tassajara this last couple of days. I remember back, 20 years since when I was there, and I remembered what it was like to sometimes walk the paths at Tassajara and feel like every step I was taking was a step of love, an intense, feeling of warmth and well-being and kind of radiating kind of kindness and love. And, just with the stepping, walking mindfully around there, and the breathing, remembering how it was like to breathe back then, and the discovery through practice, Tassajara and before that and other places, almost like how to breathe, for the first time through meditation practice, and the great freedom of the chest and the heart and diaphragm and the belly, kind of just breathing quite freely and feeling the great warmth and kind of a love that can come just with simply breathing. So it was very nice for me to be there. Also, the one last memory was very strong, which I talked about, was the experience of being there at Tassajara and being there for about, I guess, maybe a year and a half or some time. And then we hardly got much news from outside when we were there. It's kind of isolated in the Big Sur Mountains and kind of some ways shut off from the world, especially in the winter time. We don't go out or in much. And somehow or other, a more or less current Newsweek magazine ended up in my hand, and with pictures of the bombing of Israeli bombing of Beirut and the refugee camps there. Back in about 1982, maybe, 81, 82. And with the graphic photographs and headlines and reports about what was going on. And feeling tremendous pain and feeling compassion well up inside of me. Because partly in the context of the heart being so open at Tassajara and being familiar with Beirut, having been there a little bit when I was about 11. And it's feeling like this was happening in my own backyard, in a sense. And very powerful experience of compassion arising, and it in a sense became very foundational for much of my rest of the orientation of my life. So the Buddha's teaching on love. So it was the week was on that. And what are the Buddha's teachings on love? There are four types of love that's talked about by the Buddha. And usually they're called the Brahma-viharas in Pali or Sanskrit. And they are loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Equanimity, that should be a kind of love, is often a little bit of a surprise. What does that have to do with love? And maybe I'll convey some of that as we go through here. There's a beautiful analogy that's given to capture the quality of how these kinds of love. And that is a mother who has four children. And there's a relatively newborn child, a baby. There is an older child who's, with the classic text thing, they call it an invalid, someone who's quite sick. And the third child, older child, is in the text say, in the flush of youth. So it doesn't say what that means, but I suppose it means that they're flush with the vigor of a young person, the delights of exploring the world, maybe just beginning their... They're, I don't know, whatever. I see young people do. I've forgotten. and then the oldest child is someone who's established as an adult, and his family's going well, and career-wise it's going well, and everything kind of going well and established. And so... for the first child, who's a newborn baby, and kind of the anticipation of seeing a baby's healthy and loved and good circumstances, and you kind of wish, you know, you kind of see kind of ahead down through the next maybe years and decades, the future of this child and growing up, and you really want this child to be well. You're concerned about the child's welfare, and you kind of want to just this child to thrive. And so this feeling of wanting the child's best for the child. Sometimes people have little baby blessing ceremonies like we did for my child when he was born. And mostly people sat around in a circle and wished him well, you know, wished the best of him and told him that, you know, that his community was going to be there for him and support him and all these wonderful things, which I wonder how much he remembers. But it was nice for the community, nice for the parents to hear all this, and nice for all of us to kind of express our sense of welfare of the kid. And this is the quality of loving kindness, metta, goodwill, concern with the welfare, the kind of love that really wants welfare for someone. And I think one of the reasons why a young child is given as an example is with a young child, for the most part, it can be easier to see the unconditional nature of it, where, you know, you love this newborn child, and you're not expecting it to have scintillating conversation back. Or you're not expecting it to, you know, they don't even smile until 6 weeks, you know. So you don't even expect, you know, to get any kind of smile back, you know, and recognition. You don't really expect much in back from a young child. There's not an exchange kind of relationship, which sometimes it can be with love relationships. It just seems, you know, just kind of this, almost a tug and, or a kind of radiance of your heart. You encounter this young child, and some people, you know, like a parent sometimes will feel that. And so this points to this very important quality of loving kindness, is that it's a kind of love which is unconditional, which exists there regardless of what the other person does or doesn't do. It does not really about what the other person does or doesn't do, and certainly not about the person living up to our expectations or what we want or all kinds of things. So so loving kindness is just something that radiates from us directly, freely given, no expectation, and when it's really well developed, it can't be disappointed, because it doesn't belong to that realm of human relationships where we need something in return, we need to establish something in return. So even someone who's a criminal or someone who's done horrible things, it's possible to find some way to have love for them. And maybe it would look very different, the kind of love, than it would be towards someone who you really respect a lot for what they do and how they live their lives. But loving kindness is something which can be, it's a quality of the heart, wanting welfare, wanting, sometimes it's called a kind heart which can be radiated out to all beings, any beings, regardless of how they are. And it's more a quality of your heart. Your heart is kindly, and so it doesn't really matter what the person does. The person can, you know, get angry with you, and your kind heart is so secure in itself that the kind heart is not threatened or upset or challenged by even someone saying unkind things to you. The second one, second love, is compassion. And that's the mother with her invalid child, sick child. And the mother, obviously, you know, the love is expressed in the form of wanting the child's welfare. It's very concerned about the child's welfare, goes to doctors, does all kinds of things, helps the child. And, you know, it's kind of, you know, certainly is a heavier, in a sense, form of love when you encounter suffering. But when love encounters suffering, compassion is the form it takes. It's said in some schools of Buddhism that loving kindness is the base foundational form of love. And then it's like water then that flows forth from you, and depending on the container it flows into, it takes different shapes. So I think it's maybe a poor analogy, but so when loving kindness encounters suffering, it takes the shape of compassion. And at this retreat at Tassajara, we did these guided meditations on loving kindness for about 2.5 days or so, 3 days, and then we switched to compassion, and did a guided meditation on compassion. And boy, the room get heavy afterwards, you know, to kind of change the tone of everything, because appropriately, because when you encounter suffering, the quality of that love is different. The third kind of love is sympathetic joy, where the mother feels, you know, the flush of youth, the kid is maybe having some success in life, is maybe just getting married, or something's happening, you know, that the mother just feels delight and joy. that how it's going, and there's success happening and a possibility happening there. And so the mother feels, you know, the sympathetic joy, shares in the joy of someone else. And that's the shape or that loving kindness takes when someone you encounter someone else that's happy. You don't necessarily wish them well exactly because they're already well. You might wish their wellness to continue, but you know they're already well. You share in that happiness, and it's a lovely thing to do when someone shares in your happiness with you, or you can share in someone else's happiness. Though it's often said to be quite hard to experience that kind of happiness and joy. Can you hear everybody? Hear me? Okay, the speaker working. So to experience that kind of happiness, can be hard because of some tendency towards jealousy or resentment for other people being happy, and I'm not getting it, you know. But anyway, it's a beautiful thing, quality. And again, perhaps it's easier with the analogy of a parent and a child because the parent, you know, really wants these things. And the idea in Buddhism is to start appreciating the kind of love which is easy, that's almost natural to have, perhaps towards relatives, perhaps towards friends, people who there's natural. And you're not asked to get rid of it. You're not asked, you know, to deny it. What you're asked to do is to expand it so that it includes all beings. So it doesn't become partial, so it's only for certain beings or certain people, but it becomes impartial and becomes universal. Boundless is a word that's often used. So you feel the joy and delight of other people, and you share in that joy and delight. I don't know how well it worked, but one of the guided meditations I did at the retreat was I asked people to imagine all the joy and delight and success and happiness that's happening at this moment in the whole entire world of all these billions of people that we have, and imagine it all bunched together in one big, you know, glowing ball right in front of you, and just kind of sit there in the glow of this all this collective happiness. You know, and it's nice. And then the fourth kind of love is equanimity. And so this is where the mother definitely has a lot of warmth. The heart is loving and warm and soft and tender, perhaps, towards this oldest child. But everything's going well. Mother doesn't have to wish the child well. Mother doesn't have to have compassion and be concerned about the child. And the person's not having great success and happiness, but it's going pretty well. So the mother mostly feels, oh, things are good. I don't have to be so concerned about that child. And I just feel equanimity and ease. And there's a kind of maybe feeling of deep satisfaction or happiness or well-being that kind of equanimity comes with. It's a love, it's a radiance, it's a warmth of heart that is settled at ease with how things are. For one important aspect of this kind of love of equanimity is that it doesn't take responsibility for the happiness or suffering of someone else. And for me, that's probably been the most important area to learn around this fourth kind of love, equanimity, we realize that I don't have as much responsibility as my initial inclination is, whether someone's happy or sad. I kind of want to take care of everyone sometimes and sometimes take responsibility, you know, if I said it, if I did it differently or whatever. But there's something very profound to realize that ultimately, those people make their own choices. And it doesn't mean that you become cold or aloof, but you don't get this hook of the heart or the anxiety that, oh, I have to kind of get heavy or anxious because it's not happening the way it should. It might not be happening the way it should, but the hook is this personal responsibility. Make some sense? A little bit? So these are the four kinds of love. And they're very important in Buddhism. Especially in Theravadan Buddhism, early Buddhism, and they provide access to some of the most sublime and important emotions and virtues, short of what can arise through liberation and enlightenment. The Buddha encouraged people to develop them and cultivate them, and especially in a relationship to other people. They're often taken as being the teachings about how to be in relationship to other people. They're often understood to be kind of foundational for the whole Buddhist path, which I like very much because it means that the Buddhist path occurs well-founded in having healthy relationships to the world around us. There's one passage in the suttas where the Buddha says, "Imagine that there is an easily accessed pond with clear, delightful, refreshingly cool water. If a tired, parched, and thirsty person, scorched and exhausted by hot weather, came across this pond, the water would be used to quench both the person's thirst and hot weather fever. It is the same for a person who becomes a contemplative, becomes a spiritual practitioner, and after learning of the Buddha's teachings and way of life, cultivates loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. From this, the person gains inner peace, and because of this inner peace, cultivates what is appropriate for a contemplative. Isn't that beautiful? The idea that these four kinds of love bring a level of inner peace. And I think they do because in that they become a radiance of our own heart that is not dependent on what's happening in the external world in terms of getting something in return, in terms of something which helps define us, which satisfies our, you know, maybe self-centered desires, our needs. These kinds of love don't belong to that category. They don't belong to those emotions which have a relationship, which arise out of craving, arise out of aversion, arise out of fear or confusion. If we study our minds and hearts, probably recognize that often enough, the emotions that we have arise out of some relationship to desire and craving, or aversion or fear, perhaps confusion sometimes. And the whole point of the Buddhist path is to learn how to, like, or find out how to let go of these qualities, these unhelpful qualities, as a foundation as for the emotional life that we live. Emotional life is a very important part of human life. It's a very important part of Buddhist spiritual life. And I was very surprised, as I started doing Buddhist practice, the degree to which it was an emotional path, a warm-hearted path, very emotional and filled with emotions. But their emotions not rooted in these, what can sometimes called the passions. There's a very interesting controversy that existed a couple of centuries after the Buddha, where there's a group of monks who said that because the Buddha was is characterized in the discourses as being passionless, that he must have been incapable of love. And so the rejoinder, the people in the mainstream Buddhists of the time kind of responded and said, no, that's not accurate. First of all, if you read the records, the Buddha was often filled with compassion and love, and that's how he's depicted. And so the record just simply doesn't show that he was, you know, not capable of love. And in addition, he taught the importance of it. He encouraged everyone to develop compassion and loving kindness, and it's unlikely he would have encouraged people to develop it unless he felt it was a really important part of the spiritual life and something that he felt. The confusion arises over the word that's used, that's translated often in English as passion. And it's very interesting because the same confusion exists in English over the word passion as in ancient India over the word raga. Raga is, if it means any strongly motivated emotion, any strong motivation fueled by strong emotions, then probably, if the Buddha doesn't have that, then probably you have to conclude that, in fact, the Buddha is free of, you know, is not capable of any emotion at all. But if you understand raga to mean that those powerfully motivated emotions which are rooted in obsessive craving. So, for example, we talk about the lust for power, the lust for sex, the lust for money. If passion means that kind, the passion for money, the passion for sex, the passion for power, if you're talking about that kind of raga, then certainly the Buddha would be free from that. So the same confusion exists sometimes in English around the word passion, because passion has come in the last, I don't know so well, but in the last couple of decades, a very favorite word for a lot of people here in California. And people feel it's very important to live a life that's passionate. People want to have a passion. People often ask a Dharma teacher after a Dharma talk, what's wrong with passion? And I think passion is a really important part of life. And feel really troubled if they hear any suggestion that the Buddha is free of all passion. And But I think the word passion has been, the definition of it has changed over time. And just kind of it's shifted and changed, just like the word pride has shifted over the centuries. 2 centuries ago, the word pride was considered really one of the sins. It was a sinful, it was a bad thing to be prideful. And now, pride has become, the meaning of the word has been changed, and now it's something mostly it's used in a positive sense. Passion in Greek means suffering. And sometimes passion refers to this kind of, passion of lust, the passion that kind of grabs us and we don't have, we kind of beside ourselves and making choices maybe later we regret. So the Buddha, what the Buddha was free from was emotions founded in craving, in aversion, in fear, in greed, hate, and delusion, and fear. What is the emotional life of someone who has no greed, hatred, or delusion, or fear? Seemingly, there's a lot of emotion still left. And there's a lot of possibility to be motivated into these other emotions. And in fact, as greed and as fear and hate become less part of a person, the beautiful thing that happens is that it's almost as if they block those other capacities to feel emotions, to feel love of the various kinds, to feel happiness and joy, to feel faith, which is an emotion, a sense of devotion or inspiration or enthusiasm, a sense of ardency, kind of zeal, kind of passionate energy and involvement with what we're doing in a healthy way. Contentment, equanimity, tranquility, peace. There's a lot of things that we can call the kind of the helpful emotions that arise much more easy when we're not consumed by our fear and our hate. It can be a slow process to awaken those, but that's part of the beautiful thing about the practice is that slowly the heart becomes thawed. There are some other words that can be translated from the Buddhist tradition which could be translated by the English word love. And that's because the English word love is a multivalent word. It's only 4 letters, right? And it's burdened to have so many different meanings. And we use it, so casually and so heavily and so, every possible way, I just love Chinese food, perhaps as someone we know is dying, we're there by their bedside and say, I love you. And that says, carries so much meaning and weight and heartfeltness, that I love you, that we use the word love. And, the whole range in between. And there's so many different kinds of love that are included in the word, our English word love, that it's hard to know whether we're talking about the same thing when two people are talking. But another word that could be translated as love is pema. And pema in Buddhism has the connotation of meaning affection entangled with craving. So there's your craving is you want something. It isn't just simply a radiance of the heart, feeling this warmth and delight in another person's existence or this heartfelt connection with someone. But there's a wanting as part of that. I want something. And wanting isn't necessarily a bad thing, though it can create a tremendous amount of suffering, the wanting, to have something. And I think what's unfortunate is if people only think that love exists together with getting something in return or getting some desire fulfilled, then I think it becomes a kind of, a one or two dimensional life. To understand the radiance of love that doesn't require nothing in return opens up to this kind of three dimensionality of life. And I talk about the three dimensional because it's not just focused in one dimension towards that object, towards getting that. And often, I think, often enough, people want love. They think they want love, and sometimes what they want is they feel lonely, and they want somehow that loneliness to be somehow settled or filled by some contact with a person. Or they feel fear, maybe insecurity, or they feel, powerful sexual yearnings, and they have these desires around that. And so love, or the relationship, the intimate relationship, becomes in place to fulfill these other needs. One of the very important lessons I got in my life, and I got it relatively early when I was about 20 or so, I believe, maybe 20, was I was in college in the end of the spring semester. By the end of the spring semester, I had fallen in love with a couple of different people. Oh, they didn't know it. In any case, I had a girlfriend. but these two lovely people, so summer vacation came along, and I went off on my summer vacation, and I spent a lot of time out in nature, kind of a lot of time, very solitary time, and so I was still kind of filled with kind of these two people, or new people, new kind of love objects or whatever. Is that funny? And I decided that at the beginning of that summer that it was quite okay to have a fantasy life. Somehow, as a young man, I was beginning to fantasize and various things. And why not have, fantasies are fine. I don't have to inhibit my fantasies and I'll give free rein to them. And since I spent a lot of time kind of more or less alone in nature, there was a lot of time to be in my fantasies. And so fantasies were often went in the direction of these two people. And so I got to spend a lot of time with that. And what I realized after some time was that there was a difference between my love of them, my appreciation of them, my warmth and delight in just knowing who these people are, and the kind of feeling of kind of happiness, light happiness that arises whenever I thought about them because they seemed like such lovely people. And my desire for them of various kinds. And when I saw that they were two different things, then I was able to separate them a little bit, see a gap between them. And I was able then to really appreciate the sense of delight, that loving delight of who they were from my desire. And I got to choose more to hang out there. And it became, at some point, various moments at least, easier to just let go completely of those desires for that person and just really appreciate that, the warm love that need nothing in return. So in recognizing that pemma, it means affection mixed up with craving, we're not asked to abandon that. Actually, it's too easy then to throw the baby out of the bathwater, because the affection entangled with craving might have a real beautiful affection, might be a real kind of love, maybe one of these brahma-viharas. And if you kind of just throw it out because it causes pain or it seems like this neediness is part of it, it'd be very unfortunate. What we try to do then with mindfulness is to tease out, separate out that which is kind of the heart's innate capacity to radiate from that need or that desire or that fear that might be entangled with it, and separate it out enough so that we could not have them entangled and choose to follow that channel, choose to reinforce or rest in the heart's radiance. This has saved me a lot of grief growing, into my 20s and so, and made life a lot easier. And, saved me from making, helped me make less mistakes than I've made. Because I sometimes didn't feel like I needed to act on sometimes very intense feelings of love that I sometimes feel for people. Being at Tassajara again, Tassajara is a Zen monastery where they have these many, many months at a time of intensive meditation practice, monastic life. And it's a great place to kind of, for the heart to kind of soften and open up and relax. And it's often commented that Tassajara is a place where people fall in love with each other easily. And because, when your heart is really, soft and open and receptive and just feeling other people's delight and they're feeling yours and, things happen. And that certainly happened to me. And for the most part, I stayed out of trouble because I could see the difference between my desire and I was able to just appreciate, kind of rest. Sometimes you kind of rest or kind of relax back into this radiance and just bask in it at times. So love is sometimes considered, in maybe popular culture, as something that happens to you. You fall into love is the expression. And, or, you know, it's chemistry. You know, why do you love that person? Oh, it's chemistry. You know, which means I don't have no idea why it's there, but but you know, these things happen. You know, these elements kind of came together. It was chemistry, you know, and you know, chemical combination of things, you know, take many different forms. You know, sometimes they're explosive. You get the wrong chemicals together, and, you know, and sometimes you put certain chemicals together and they separate. And sometimes they mix, and sometimes they become solid, and sometimes they vaporize, you know. And so, it, you know, it's chemistry. What does that mean? something just happens, you know. In the Buddhist tradition, love is not left to chance, but rather is something that can be cultivated. And our capacity to love is something that can be developed. As it's developed, it becomes something that becomes easier to have and a more regular part of a person, closer at hand, ready to happen, ready to kind of just to be a default mode, perhaps, for the first person. You learn various skills and abilities and wisdom around the topic of love. And so they're available to you in all kinds of settings. And love then becomes a much more common part of your life. I know 20 years ago, I would have thought that anything besides chemistry, anything besides the natural arising of love, I would have considered artificial. You can't manufacture love. You can't make it happen. And anything that's artificial and made up, that's not really love and doesn't count. And perhaps there's some truth to that, but we can expand our capacity. You know, if love is an accident, if we accept that, then practice makes us accident prone. So we can cultivate the capacity to that's more likely going to happen. And it can be as simple as taking the time to appreciate people. So one of the exercises I had people do at this retreat this last week, we had about a 4-hour break in the afternoon in this very intensive retreat that we were involved in. So I sent them off for their 4-hour break and asked them for one afternoon to do people watching. And to look at people and, you know, the monastery and just watch people, the other people, the guests and the other people who work there and stuff and see what can you appreciate in those people. Take the time to look at those people and see, look at their eyes, look at their hearts, look at them somehow. And can you find some way of appreciating them? Just look at them, see if you can see their loveliness. Because the proximate cause for the arising of loving kindness is seeing the goodness and the loveliness in other people. Now, are people only lovely when you stop, when you look at them? You know, when you finally stop and take it easy and spend time looking at them and appreciating them? You know, until you take the time, until that very small window of 5 minutes where you stop to kind of look at them like this, you know, appreciate them, they're not lovely at all. You know, just, you know, you kind of made it happen by looking at them for 5 minutes and, you know. They're probably lovely the 5 minutes before also, or, you know, the day before, you know, probably lovely much of the time. So one of the causes of being more accident prone is just simply taking the time to love people, to look at them, to somehow learn to appreciate them, give them the time of day, and do people watching. Spend the time, you know, having a kind of eyes, having the kind of mind that's not preoccupied all the time with your own thoughts and concerns, but kind of listens more deeply or looks more deeply or settles back and just watches the person, or they don't have to know you're watching them, but somehow taking them in. Take the time to do it. Take both the physical time, but take the mental time. So the mind is not in other places and activities, but who is this person? Really see the person. Simply sitting opposite someone and not talking and looking very generally at their chest or at their eyes or at their face. Generally, it tends to produce a lot of tenderness. Just if you have that kind of intimate time of looking at people and being with people. So developing our capacity to love can be simply developing our capacity to give ourselves a little bit more time in the day, to feel that it's valuable to look at people, to sense people more, to get to know people more. Is it, you know, it's so, I know it's very easy in life to think that a lot of other things are much more important than just, you know, people watching, sitting there on the sidewalk, you know, and watching people go by and appreciating them, or watching your friends. It can seem petty and small thing until you realize that small little habits, small little practices we do build up momentum over time until they become a strong part of who we are. And love, the capacity to love each other, is one of the most beautiful things human beings can do on this planet. And it's, you know, it doesn't need to be said how much the world needs to have that. But it maybe does need to be said that probably most of you need it. Not because it's morally your obligation to love other people, but it's just like one of the most healing things for your heart, for yourself. One of the most beautiful things for you to experience. One of the high pinnacles of human life is to be able to feel this warmth and delight and in relationship to other people. It becomes this radiance. And it occurred to me in the retreat to say to the people in the retreat that they're supposed to become full of themselves. I think in English that's not supposed to be a kind of good thing to be, right? You know, the person's full of himself or herself. But you're supposed to be full of yourself, in a sense, filled with this loving kindness, filled with this sense of love. So it's a practice, and the practice of filling ourselves with love is one of the important Buddhist practices. And so there are more than just taking the time to appreciate people. There are actually, you take, including yourself, you must take time to appreciate yourself. There are practices which we did on the retreat, meditative practices, where you sit in meditation and you try to connect with your desire, your intention, your motivation for people's welfare, for their best, for their happiness. If you want their happiness, which is a kind of the love of the mother with her newborn child. You should find that intention, that wish, that desire that you have, which is considered to be healthy, appropriate, can be, unless it's mixed up with other things like expectation and demand. And maybe try to get a strong sense of the person that you want to cultivate this loving kindness towards. Maybe imagine them, use your powers of visualization. And then you give voice to that intention. And giving voice to our intentions, to our feelings and emotions, is one of the ways to let them grow and develop. So it's done through this loving kindness practice where you do it in silence and meditation. But for example, if you do it towards a friend, you imagine your friend and sense it or think about your friend in some way, hold the friend there in front of you. And then you see if you can find out even a rudimentary wish that your friend be happy. Some desire you want, really want the best for your friend. And then you, with a very gentle voice, as gentle as you can, a silent voice in your back of your mind, you kind of say, may it be, may you be happy. May you be safe. May you be healthy. May you be at ease. And each time you say those words, there's many ways of doing this practice. Each person finds their own. But I find it very helpful to pause at the end of saying it. May you be happy. And in that pause, kind of like plunging into that silence or plunging into that pause, is I let go of any other thoughts that has arisen. Because the mind is very easy, you know, to start thinking, and especially think on different tracks but something else. But into the silence, you let go of any tendency to think the best you can, at least soften it. And while you let go of any other thoughts, I try to sink into the meaning or the intention or the feeling that's behind that particular word. May you be happy. So it's meditative in that you're letting go of your distractions. You're having this concentration on these particular things, the phrases, the image of the person, your motivation. And so it's a concentration practice, it's steadying the mind. And it helps kind of water the seeds of that intention. It grows. As intention grows, sometimes a feeling of happiness, delight, of love grows in the person. And as it grows, the instructions is to allow it to suffuse, to fill your whole being. And in fact, not only fill your whole being, but suffuse it out beyond the boundaries of your body and have a sense of love that radiates out from you in all directions, boundlessly for all beings. As the mind gets concentrated doing these phrases, doing this loving kindness practice, it turns out that a concentrated mind is much more fertile ground or receptive ground for being changed, conditioned, transformed, informed by these intentions you're stating. The mind which is distracted and concerned about all kinds of preoccupations is not really going to take in these seed words, these seed intentions that are sometimes referred to as, down in the deep recesses of the mind, the hearts of the mind, the mind of the heart of the mind. And when you're able to get your mind very still and very concentrated, saying those phrases reaches really deep down to the roots of your being and helps to change that, to soften it, to transform it. It's very, very powerful to do this. And as it becomes almost like a disposition that becomes partly who you are. Your disposition tends to move towards becoming more of a kindly disposed to people. You're kind. You may be more compassionate. So some people will cultivate this as a meditation practice as their only practice for days, weeks, months, years at a time. There are stories of monks in Thailand, monks and nuns, who this is their primary meditation practice, is a practice of loving kindness. And just being around them, you feel this tremendous radiance of love, of delight, of kindness, of warmth. And it's great, I would think. This is probably the kind thing to stop on time. So I hope that I was able to convey a little bit to you how important it is in Buddhist spirituality, these four forms of love. And I hope that perhaps inspired a little bit maybe to appreciate them and maybe be inspired maybe to try them out, to experiment with them, learn more about them. And if nothing else, appreciate that each of you has the capacity to feel these four loves and has the capacity to express them in your life with others and with yourself. And it's not something foreign to who you are. It's as if they're innate to you, what your heart really is. And all you need to do is get out of the way enough for them to radiate and shine forth. So may all of you be happy. May all of you be filled with joy and delight. May all of you live your life with at ease and at peace. May all beings be happy. Thank you.